Healthcare to order.
Wait till our blue. There we go.
Call the House Committee on Healthcare to order. Second one was a better recording. And open a informational meeting on well, let's start with healthcare acquired infections. And Sean, you want to kick off? And who else are? Who else you want to have? I see Mr. Dameron there, your co-chair.
Right.
You can have anybody flying wing you want. We're asking if you'll introduce this, Madam Committee Administrator, why we have these folks here today. See, I always don't ask you.
I know. Can you catch, because you asked to have an update on this, Mr. Chair?
Because we passed the bill in the 2007 session, and they've been working on it, and Mr. Comer is staffing that effort, and Mr. Dameron's partly leading it, co-leading that effort, and we thought it would be good to hear how things were going. We've also asked the folks from Legacy, who've been doing some work in their own healthcare system, to join us as well.
Right. Fair Green Lake members of the committee, for the record, Sean Comer, Deputy Administrator, Office of Health Policy and Research, and I am joined today by my esteemed colleagues, Alyssa Tran, who's the new Research and Data Manager for OHPR, and Jim Dameron in his role as the co-chair of the Healthcare Acquired Infections Advisory Committee.
We finally found somebody good to fill that role.
Finally, right. Hopefully you're getting copies of what we sent over, of what we'll be talking about, and giving you an overview of the program that we've been running out of OHPR and being advised by our advisory committee. And as soon as I can unlock my computer, I will put it up on the screen.
You want to go do that for him? Is that what we emailed you?
Mm-hmm.
That's okay. Hey, Chief.
Oh. The answer is yes.
Oh, yeah, I know. Allison responded right away. I was pretty sure. Just checking.
So, as we're waiting for technology to catch up with us, our first slide here is sort of a frame of reference about the importance of healthcare acquired infections and specifically the reporting of them. So just as a refresher, healthcare acquired infections are infections that patients contract while receiving care, so something they did not come into a facility with and wound up getting it while they were at a particular facility. The classic Center for Disease Control numbers are in front of you in that second bullet, talking about number of infections nationally, deaths, and sort of excess costs associated with those. Then we have estimated that between 5 and 15% of all hospitalized patients experience a healthcare acquired infection. So in 2007, this body passed House Bill 2524, which gave the Office for Health Policy and Research a mandatory reporting program of healthcare acquired infections. Broadly, it gave our office authority for reporting in hospitals, nursing facilities, ambulatory surgery centers, outpatient dialysis centers, and freestanding birthing centers. And then below you see two of the statutory goals of the program. One, to provide useful and credible infection measures specific to each healthcare facility and make sure that information is relevant for consumers. And then to promote quality improvement in those healthcare facilities. So through the initial passage and implementation, we've had a variety of avenues for stakeholder input to our program. The first and foremost is our HAI Advisory Committee, which was statutorily created. It consists of a variety of members and experts from hospital administrators, providers, public health professionals, infection control practitioners, consumers, purchasers. Currently, it's co-chaired by, as I mentioned, Jim Dameron of the Oregon Patient Safety Commission, and Woody English, a physician from the Providence Medical System. We have continued collaboration and partnership with the Hospital Association, with infection control practitioners in the state. They're a professional organization known as APIC, the Oregon Public Health Department and the CDC, and of course, all of our meetings are public, so we've had the great opportunity to hear a lot from the public around implementation of this program. So our first step in implementing this program...
Live, you see, now. Excuse me. So you're live now.
Oh, I'm live now. Yeah. Excellent. The first step of implementation for us was around hospitals. We established those requirements through administrative rule in July of 2008, and that became effective January 1 of 2009. So basically we gave hospitals about 6 months to prepare what they needed to prepare to meet the requirements that we set forth through administrative rule. We have clinical outcome measures around central line associated bloodstream infections and around infections for two surgical procedures, coronary artery bypass surgery and knee replacement procedures. We also collect and will eventually report nationally endorsed process measures known as SKIP measures. So those are sort of that was the first wave of implementation for the program. The second step, which we took in July of 2009, was expansion of the reporting program, both within hospitals and then for some of the other facilities that I mentioned earlier. So for hospitals, we have adopted measures in neonatal intensive care units, and we've also are in the process of developing and fielding a survey around staff influenza vaccination rates. We then expanded to nursing facilities and ambulatory surgery centers, nursing facilities around urinary tract infection reporting, and then again the same survey of staff influenza rates as in hospitals. And then for ambulatory surgery centers, I think what we really found out was we just really need to understand sort of the best practices within surgery centers in Oregon, and the best way for us to do that would be a survey of best practices and what they're doing, aligning with national organizations like the Joint Commission as one example, and other accrediting agencies and how they ask for that type of information. So what are your infection control procedures, that sort of stuff. So the question we get asked quite a bit is, how do we collect outcomes? How do we collect clinical outcomes? The advisory committee endorsed and we adopted what's called the National Healthcare Safety Network, NHSN for short, which is a program that's administered by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, which is designed to be a reporting tool for outcome measures of infection rates. Some of the advantages we see of NHSN is it standardizes clinical definitions and methodology, so everybody's getting as close to apples as they can. It allows comparisons both between states and nationally. We believe it provides useful, actionable data to infection and prevention specialists to sort of do the work that they need to do. There are no software hardware costs, no maintenance fees, but there are staff requirements. I don't want to say that lightly. There are staff commitments, and you'll probably hear a little bit about that, but we have also heard about that during our implementation of this program. It provides for risk adjustment, so again, making sure the patient pool that we're comparing facility to facility is relatively similar. And recently, through the federal stimulus package, there was funding for the U.S. HHS to have an action plan for prevention, so a five-year prevention plan, and they're supporting and adopting the use of NHSN for states, especially in state-mandated programs. This just gives you a little bit of a flavor about what other states are doing in comparison to NHSN as a reporting tool. The blue are states that use NHSN for mandatory infection reporting. The sort of striped lines there are they currently have mandates, but they don't use NHSN. They might use a variant of it or some other homegrown system. And then the sort of lighter shaded are states who have pending legislation, but nothing sort of in the books yet. as we've been implementing a new system, we think it's pretty important to talk about the success of hospitals to actually do this. Before NHSN, it was a voluntary CDC program, so some hospitals in the state were participating before our program came along, and we think that's about 10 hospitals. And as of January of 2010, 50 hospitals are currently using NHSN, with 7 hospitals in the state receiving waivers from our office for reporting. The most prominent reason for that is they don't have any of the procedures that we're targeting during our reporting program. We feel like that we couldn't have done this alone, especially with the great partnership with the Hospital Association and Oregon APIC for implementation. As an example, the three of us co-sponsored a training in September of 2008, where infection control practitioners were all in a room together talking about how to implement NHSN, and really as hands-on as you really could have gotten around understanding what the requirements are, what it means, how to use it, how to generate reports out of it, sort of the nuts and bolts of how to use the system. And that wouldn't have been possible without that partnership. And as I mentioned earlier, some hospitals have raised concerns about the staff burden of NHSN, and we've heard that pretty loudly, and CDC has been hearing that from other communities as well. So I don't want to sort of brush by that and not give it its due credence.
Sean, how many elements are there in HSN?
Chair Greenlick, I'd have to get back to you on that. It's a fairly long laundry list of data elements.
A lot, though, right?
A lot, correct.
Are these hospitals using that lot, or are they using some of them?
They're using, Chair Greenlick, they're using a subset that we require them to use. But some hospitals, as I'll show you later, are going above and beyond what we require for their own purposes. Chair Greenlick, as you beat me to my slide. So 24 hospitals are currently using NHSN for things that we have not required them to use them for. Just to give you a perspective, large DRG hospitals, so large urban hospitals, but 10 of them are sort of the small rural hospitals, type Bs to be exact. And these are some of the things below that they're using NHSN for, to sort of do infection control practices, quality improvement, measurement. So hip replacements, colon surgeries, urinary tract infections, and ventilator-associated pneumonia. So again, things that in our program we haven't required, but facilities are choosing to use NHSN for a variety of reasons. In our technical support and communication with hospitals, we tend to have a lot of one-on-one conversations with the folks on the ground who are actually doing the data input, doing the quality improvement, doing the infection prevention. And this is a comment that I think resonates with some of the comments that we're getting from hospitals around the value of NHSN, especially in this case for a new infection control practitioner at a very small rural hospital. So again, a type A hospital has less than 25 beds. So a really small hospital that may or may not have had systems in place to do the kind of infection reporting that this program hopes to lead. So what are the next steps in our process? The first next big step is the first public report in the spring of 2010, and that report will show you at least some data similar to this. This is knee replacement infection rates in Oregon. The hospitals have been blinded and gives us a state rate and a national rate. So as you can see, between hospital A, B, C, and D, there is tremendous variation in the infection rates for this particular procedure. So again, I think this provides us an opportunity to figure out where the best practices are happening and really sort of drive quality improvement around particular issues. We're talking about, with our advisory committee and stakeholders, how to expand the reporting requirements for hospitals through NHSN, being mindful of making smart choices and how we do that. And how we've been doing that to date is we presented as OHPR and staff to the advisory committee a draft proposal, which is affectionately called the blueprint, that would basically expand infection reporting through the NHSN system. We would also look at what's commonly referred to as multi-drug-resistant organism reporting, so MRSA, C. difficile, other issues. We know we have to tackle it, but I don't think we're quite there in understanding how to actually get the information.
Can we go back
to
that slide? In? Anytime you'd like to ask questions, I think we have time.
Yeah.
Okay.
You don't mind if we do it that way?
Chair Greenlick, any way you like is fine with me.
Thank you. Well, we could, if you prefer, we can go your whole panel and then come back with questions if that's...
It's up to you, Chair Greenlick.
Well, let me ask this question. That, when you're reporting, when you go live with that reporting, there'll actually be the names of the hospitals, is that right?
Chair Greenlick, correct.
Wow. And the number of incidents, I suppose, as well, the number of cases that underlies these.
Chair Greenlick, that's currently under discussion with our advisory group on sort of how to best report that, and we're sort of leaning on our infection control experts to tell us how to do that. I think we're also thinking about our consumer representation, figuring out what's sort of meaningful to report. So
we can talk about that when we...
Yeah, it's all on the table. Correct.
Just fire away.
Just fire away, please. Okay. And you just answer. You don't need to come through me in these,
okay,
these hearings.
Sorry, I wound up getting here late. You are Sean, correct? Sean Comer?
Correct.
Okay, thanks. Sean. Did you generate these at the health authority level, this particular table, or did you rely upon data coming in from the hospitals? Leave it right there, question mark.
Yeah. Vice Chair Harker, the way that the system works is hospitals and their systems will then interface with NHSN, input the data, and then we sort of had administrative rights over top of the data. So then we go in and get it and do this analysis.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
That's what I assumed.
Correct.
But a little bit down the line here, you're talking about asking the hospitals to generate X, Y, and Z reports. Why would they do that? Why would you not be able to do that with that same authority that you have?
No, Vice Chair Harker, what we're saying is, I think what you're referring to is the reports that they would generate out of NHSN would be for their own internal purposes. There's a lot of features that NHSN provides that allow hospitals to sort of benchmark themselves. So anything that a hospital would potentially be able to do, we could do as an administrator of the system.
You answering the question. Next question then is, why would you require them to do it? If you're able to look at they're inputting the data, you get the... over the summary view of the data, you can make observations, reports, etc., spanning in institutions this way that will benefit us and the plan and the people in the state going forward. Am I misunderstanding and thinking you're going to require them to do it, which is what I thought it said there?
Vice Chair Harker, we're not going to require them to do any reporting other than the data input.
Okay.
If that answers the question, I think it does.
Thanks.
Yeah,
the reporting requirement
reporting
is
of the data.
More elements.
Right.
Right. Is that the... I mean, that's what this slide refers to.
Are you referring to this line?
Very good.
This
slide?
Yeah.
Yep.
And then also in talking about expansion, there's been a lot of discussion about what's affectionately termed as structure process measures. So what does a safe facility look like? Leaning again on sort of prevention best practices, very much in line with sort of the SCIP measures and other nationally endorsed things, but really figure out what would be a good measure here and how to adopt those certain things. The way the proposal is outlined or principles are really we're trying to include as many hospitals as we can. There is a variety of different complexities in those facilities, so in some instances, for as an example, heart surgeries, only about 11 facilities in Oregon do them. So do we really want to spend a whole lot of time and effort sort of focusing in that area versus a procedure like knee replacement, which happens in almost 50 hospitals in the state? So to make comparisons to comparisons, that's how we're judging at least some of the things that we're talking about. And then where there's conditions and procedures where national data suggests higher infection rates. So really, again, focusing on the number of facilities that might be impacted, also aligned with really high infection rates based on what national data we do have. The proposal also talks about phasing in expansion to make it clear how we're expanding the program and when. So facilities have ample time to plan and not just 3 months, 6 months, 9 months. And enough measures so that we can really have a hospital infection rate. I think what we've heard around NHSN specifically is the surgery infection data input is onerous, to say the least. So for us to make smart choices within NHSN in order to expand. So the idea of just breaking the dam open and letting the water flow through NHSN hasn't really been the advice we've gotten from our advisory committee and the public. So we have to figure out what those choices are within NHSN that make it valuable. And then we really have wanted to get great input from the hospital community to make sure that, again, they have information.
Maybe I need to ask Jim that. How do you get information from the public, and how active is the public? We had a lot of advocacy pushing this bill. How actively are they involved in writing testimony and things to your advisory board?
Let me reintroduce myself. Excuse me. I've lost my voice for some reason. Jim Dameron, co-chair of the advisory committee. Chair Greenlich, the advisory committee meets every other month. Public input and interest in the committee has been growing steadily. Our last meeting, there were quite a few people there. There is good public consumer representation on the advisory committee. So our discussions at the advisory level feel robust, feel engaged from multiple points of view. Hospitals, as they see what reporting looks and feels like and what resources are required, are increasingly active in making their case for one approach or another. The Hospital Association has been very active. And so to me, from my point of view, it feels like it's been a very creative kind of discussion. Sean mentioned implementation of the first wave of this reporting program. Training for that was shared by many different kinds of organizations. There was an awful lot of mentoring going on amongst hospitals as hospitals tried to figure it out. So that was an interesting process. But I think we are really at an important juncture for the program in two ways, at least two ways. We've worked, remember the whole premise of this is we're going to put public information in play at the hospital level. That's the whole intent here. And the change will occur, positive quality improvement will occur because of that. We could argue the mechanics of that, but that's the intent. And in April, we're going to have our first report. And so that's critical. And how we do that and how we share that and how we talk about it is going to be a really important piece of this whole effort. We are from the working, thinking just about hospitals. We've gone through now, we're in our third iteration of trying to grow the program. First wave, few measures. Second wave, a couple of additional so-called process or structural measures. Now we have this blueprint in play that would be an important and fairly large expansion of the program across three new domains, three new ideas. So how we manage that, the speed that we manage that, the input that we get for that, really two critical things here going on in the present tense.
How many public members are on that group? People affiliated with hospitals?
Two.
It may be robust in expression, but not necessarily a number, is that?
Well, it's a small group, but active participation. They're active participants. I think they have equal representation and voice to more traditional professional interest. Are not shy about that. I don't know how to characterize that except to say that if this project has an accelerator and we could argue about whether the accelerator has been pushed fast enough, it's usually the consumer members who are saying faster, faster, faster. So critical role there.
We may get to that when we're done. I'm sorry, Sean. Please go ahead.
It's okay. Chair Greenlich, just to reiterate what Jim was saying about membership as well, there are three quote-unquote public members that were statutorily assigned. One true consumer that we have on the group.
All true consumers of hospital services.
Correct.
Unfortunately.
But not directly employed by a healthcare facility, correct? So there's only really three people on the committee at this point out of the 14 members that don't have sort of a healthcare funding, so to speak. So I think lastly, as far as the next steps for the program, we really want to strengthen our technical assistance capabilities. We got additional funding with a partnership through the Public Health Department and the Oregon Patient Safety Commission through ARRA funding to provide better technical support to hospitals. We're still trying to figure out what that looks like. and also having continued conversations with the Hospital Association, APIC, and other relevant stakeholders to figure out how we can sort of beef up our technical assistance around our reporting. We're also not just looking at hospitals, but also looking at some of the other facilities and what makes sense. We're convening a subcommittee on nursing facilities. The large committee has said pretty loudly that we need to figure out how to understand nursing facilities. I don't think anybody's quite got the magic bullet yet, so we have to do a lot of homework before we talk about expanding further into nursing facilities.
Sean?
Yeah.
Thank you. What do you mentioned the, I think you said the awards that you got under the Recovery Act for helping with technical
Correct.
Support for
Correct.
Some of the facilities. What do you think that might look like? What are they needing?
Vice Chair Harker, what folks are needing is some of it is just basic, how do I work the program? What happens when my digital certificate expires? How do I make it right?
Some are the certs put in at CDC, or is it something that
CDC
you folks
does
are involved
so
with?
So folks have to go log in on their particular machines mm-hmm. and get it, and they expire yearly.
Yep, and they forget how they did
right,
it.
Right, so they forget
before.
How to
okay.
do it. Mm-hmm. So some of it's just that. And then some of it really is infection control practices, is really getting that sort of core group together to sort of mentor each other around, you know, is this really an infection? The definitions tell us it, but it still doesn't quite match up. Does it count? Those types of things. So that's where there's two pieces. One piece, the technical side around the system, we can interface with CDC pretty readily. It's sort of that next level down of where the public health department and other stakeholders are really assisting us with.
Do you envision hiring someone or alternatively contracting with someone out in the world to provide FTEs of tech support to these folks?
Vice Chair Harker, that is under discussion
okay.
currently.
There's funding in the grant?
The jobs program. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah.
No citizen. Yes?
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
So with our end goal for our next steps around expansion is to, as we've done almost for our summer break every year, adopt new rules for expansion. What that really looks like when we get there is to be determined, but that's sort of our vision at this point. So I will be done killing you by PowerPoint, and we'll ask any more questions that you might have, and I'd be more than happy to provide any other information you think you need.
Jim, did you finish what you wanted to say? The podium, run with it. We haven't driven you crazy on the Patient Safety Commission this session.
Chair Greenlick, I don't really have anything to say other than there are multiple efforts going on in the state to deal with healthcare acquired infections. And one of the challenges and one of the possibilities is can we coordinate all those efforts? Do they add up to something that makes sense? And the ARRA grant that we've talked about is about technical assistance. It's all about, and it's also about providing funding for a healthcare collaborative, a hospital collaborative, to bring 10 to 15 hospitals together to work on the nitty-gritty of how can hospitals better lower their infection rate. So we have a reporting program. We publicly put some of that information in play. Hospitals are doing, I think, a good job in reducing their infection rates. There's a lot more to do. This collaborative that's funded with these federal dollars and that is organized by the Patient Safety Commission, that's our piece of the R grant, is an effort to drive change in that collaborative, what are you doing that works approach. So that's ongoing. That's actively going on right now and will run through December of next year. There's an attempt to create a statewide plan that says here are the things that we in Oregon think are important with regard to infections and how are we then going to make progress on those. So it's an attempt at its best to knit together public interest, private interest, federal dollars, state oversight, to make a plan that actually drives us to change. And this public reporting piece is a critical piece of that.
You're working on that in your quality improvement models through the Patient Safety Commission, the same area, aren't you?
Correct. my take is that there's different pressure points, different ways to drive change. Public reporting is one. Quality improvement is directly working with delivery system folks, safe table approaches, finding best practices and sharing those. There's different models for how change can work. We're trying to align those different efforts around a short list of serious problems. And the question is always needs to be asked, do they add up? And so we're working hard to make sure that they do.
Or even more.
I have all sorts of questions about the granularity of the data that are being collected at all the different institutions. Now, I don't want to go into that here. I don't think that's what we need to spend the committee time on. But are the data free of HIPAA concerns to the extent that some members of the committee might be able to look at them?
Individually identified data, you mean?
Correct.
Vice Chair Harker, that is my understanding, but I have to get back to you on that.
Okay.
Yeah. Your understanding is that they can look at individual data?
Correct. That's my understanding, but I could be smarter tomorrow.
Okay. If you would get back,
I'll
to
get
me
back
on
to
that,
you.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
I'd love to be able to look in there
right.
and play with it.
Right.
Thanks.
Some members of this
also.
Committee? Was that the question?
Is that
someone
Harker's
question?
No, were you asking a question some members of this committee, or were you talking about their committee?
This committee.
I think
well,
Mr. Harker's
there, there are ways that we can get either. Waivers, that we can sign waivers for various
okay.
things like that, and I wouldn't be surprised.
Wow.
We have some researchers around here. That's your problem to deal with. Other questions?
Yeah. I do have a big general question, Sean, and you and I have talked about it,
yep.
so... this isn't, I'm not sandbagging you with this question, but there are various ways to get data, and the HS, whatever it is one, and a good one, and an efficient one for all the reasons you say, but there are other kinds of data available, and the reason I was asking Jim about the role of the advocates is I know originally the advocates were very anxious to have hospital-wide grosser data measures that comes from somewhere, some magic place, fully recognizing that data is not as pure and as risk-adjusted as other kinds of data. And in other places in this field, we've done things like put data out first and straighten it out later. By the time we straighten out the later, we found out the people who look bad and what they consider bad data all of a sudden didn't look bad anymore because they went and fixed the problems that were inherent. Are there possibilities that you'll be doing other kinds of gross hospital data reports, total hospital infections per admission or per day in the hospital or something like that, in addition to the kind of eloquent, really nice, highly reliable data that will come out of the models you're working now?
Chair Greenlich, yes. I mean, I think what you're referring to is administrative billing data that our office currently gets. So we have the ability, based on how things are coded, to sort of estimate infection rates around certain things. So we can do that kind of work, and we have in the past. In 2005, we published a brief that used that kind of data. And we're investigating using that kind of data as a validation tool, although not the best one, but sort of approximation of what we think we should be getting versus what we have inside of NHSN. So we are using it as sort of a supplemental data source.
I think it would be very useful to see some of that data, even if it's blind at the hospital at that point in the early runs. I mean, it was very similar to the early data on maternal mortality that came out of California hospitals, which wasn't risk-adjusted and took some time to get straightened out, but I happen to know a lot of the hospitals actually changed their behavior, all the while denying the data really was right.
Right.
I think even doing that, you know, with hospital A, B, C, D, and E, to see what the variation is on those things would be very useful, and I think it would be very useful to the individual hospitals to see
what their data looks like compared to the other hospitals. So.
And Chair Greenlink, I think that what you're pointing out too is we have, on one side we're using an HSN, which is a system that's really clinically driven, and then if we use administrative billing data, that's where you start talking about what's the cost to Oregon's system, what's the potential cost and the excess cost that, say, CDC talks about and touts quite a bit, and that's where you would find that kind of data anyway. So to get any sort of cost estimates, that's where we would look first.
Great. Other questions? Are you going to have anything to talk to us about today?
Not today, sir.
He just brought you along in case somebody asked a real question.
Right.
So you can answer.
Right.
Well, you're welcome. Is this your first time before one of the committees?
Chair Greenlick, no. I was a budget administrator for children, adults, and families.
You're an old hand, though. Yeah, you've been here a lot. Okay. Well, thank you all very much. Let's now ask one of the hospital systems that's working on this from a different side to come and talk to us. And we have, who do we have? Dr. Chiaffi, Jody Joyce, somebody else? No, that'll be it.
Hi.
From the Legacy Health System. Thank you very much for coming. We really appreciate it. See if you can make the computer work.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, I'm Jack Chaffee. I'm the Chief Medical Officer for the Legacy Health System. We want to tell you a story, actually, of things that have been going on over the last 2 years, and it relates directly to what we just heard. And it's our focus on eradicating hospital-associated infections, and we'll get to which ones we've been working on and the progress that we've made. For those of you that don't know us, Legacy Health is a six-hospital system centered here in Portland, in the Portland area in Oregon, comprises of Emanuel, Good Sam, Meridian Park, and Mount Hood in Oregon, as well as the Children's Hospital at Emanuel, and we have one north of the river, Salmon Creek Hospital. We employ just over 9,000 people, do over 56,000 inpatient procedures annually, and another half million outpatient. We provide community benefit. Actually, this last number from last year represents about a 15-16% increase from the previous year. Much of that is done through uninsured care. The story begins actually in March of 2008, and we met with our board, had an outside consultant from IHI come to visit.
IHI?
Institute for Healthcare Improvement, suggested that although our numbers at the time in terms of hospital-acquired infections looked pretty good, and we were pretty confident they were good, that we could make some headway. This particular person, James Reinertsen, actually challenged us to set some lofty goals, and we adopted what we ended up calling the Big Aims. Our fiscal year, and you'll see some fiscal year data, begins in April and goes through March, and that's how we use that instead of the calendar year. So in March of 2008, we set the goals of eliminating needless death and eliminating preventable harm within our hospital system. We thought world peace was a little overrated, so we chose these two. But honestly, we'd seen other hospital systems around the country, or at least individual hospitals, drive down hospital-acquired infections. And we knew that there's a direct correlation between these infections and death of patients. There are hospital-associated infections that if you get them, it increases your mortality some 10 to 40%, depending on what it is and what your associated conditions are. And so we set pretty aspirational goals. We're going to walk you through the first-year goals that we set, how we went after it, and what we've accomplished in the last 2 years. With me today is Jody Joyce, our Vice President of Patient Safety and Quality for the system.
Good afternoon.
We could have stopped there and felt good about what we set as a lofty goal and realized the real work.
Could you introduce yourself?
Do you need me to introduce myself? I'm sorry. I'm Jody Joyce, Vice President for Quality and Patient Safety with Legacy Health. We established our first installment toward these long-term goals by establishing target and stretch goals, one for mortality of a reduction of 5 to 10%, and the second, a reduction target and stretch of 10 to 20% for healthcare-acquired infections. And we'd be happy to come back another time to talk about what we've done with mortality, but we're going to focus most of the rest of our conversation on what we've done with healthcare-acquired infections.
Indeed, come back to talk about it.
So we really decided that part of our approach needed to be to have an overall strategy for how we were addressing our improvement work. And so we really adopted the leadership leverage framework that's one of the pieces of work out of the Institute for Healthcare Improvement that outlines seven key principles. The first is about setting system-wide aims that are overseen at the highest level of the organization. The second is to develop an executable strategy that has a manageable number of projects that comprise your overall objective and for that to be overseen by administration. The third is channeling attention that includes time and resources and energy. Fourth is around getting patients and families on the team. We refer to it as bringing the patient into the room. Some of that is virtual and some of that is literal. Fifth is around engaging the CFO, or more broadly, of ensuring that we're making the investments in quality and safety that we need to be making as an organization. The sixth is around engaging physicians, and I would say maybe the short version of that is of identifying how to adopt our physicians' agenda instead of trying to get them to adopt ours. And the final one is around ensuring that we are not only driving improvement, but we are building capacity and capability for improvement across our organization. We had a very focused plan. I won't go into all of the details, but basically three components. The first are two overarching goals around mortality and infections, and the four infections that we targeted included vent-associated pneumonia, central line-related bloodstream infections, surgical site infections, and cap-associated urinary tract infections. The middle column of this plan is really a key part. Again, we won't belabor this today, but we asked ourselves the questions, if we're to get to a different level of performance, what fundamentally would need to change within our organization? And these were the three key drivers that we identified. The first one around consistency in our processes, consistency in our care. Second, around teamwork and communication, really engaging from leaders to frontline staff, everyone in this plan. And the third, around engagement and education of our physicians and our staff. And then our projects were limited to three primary things that included best practice bundles. We'll talk about that a little bit more in a moment. Multidisciplinary rounds, which is essentially on a daily basis, getting the doctors and the nurses and everyone else caring for the patient to talk about the plan, make sure you have a single aligned one. And then finally, a mortality drill down and action plan for each of our hospitals. For fiscal year 10, we set the bar higher. We saw that we were making good progress and realized our work wasn't yet done. So our mortality goal was set to 10% and our infection reduction goal to 50%. Jack's going to talk about how we're doing.
So this was both from a baseline that was taken in the first quarter of 08 calendar year that we established. We actually...
Jack, is that 50% of all infections?
50% of those four selected infections.
Those four infections.
Those four infections.
Do you know what percent those four infections are of your total infections?
Do you know the actual number?
The vast majority.
No. And they're the ones that produce the most significant morbidity and mortality. They are the ones that are best in the literature spelled out of plans of attack, in terms of plans of attack.
But your high aims back there, which had a 10% to 20%, was that was intended to be a reduction in all infections, wasn't it?
It was those four.
Those four. And I think, actually, it's a good point, Chair Greenlich, that we need to focus. And I think focus is what's going to allow us to succeed in both counting and then making sure that we've taken interventions that have an effect. And what worries me a little bit is if we have infections that don't have a downside or a significant downside on the list as equal to a ventilator-associated pneumonia, then we'll start diluting our ability to actually both count and make change. So we
your high system aims then ought to be reduce certain infections by 10%. Not reduce infections by 10%.
Again, this is overwhelming, and I can get you a number on what percent of infections this is, but this is overwhelming hospital-associated infections, urinary tract infections from catheters, central line infections, which were mentioned earlier, ventilator-associated pneumonia, which in some of our hospitals has essentially been eradicated, something 20 years ago. We just took for granted that it was going to happen 20% of the time. Surgical site infections, which again, we have a long way to go, but I think as a community, we're doing better with things like the SCIP initiative. So where have we gone over the last almost 2 years? This is our mortality graph, and you'll notice a couple things. This is rate, so this is per 100 patients discharged. And we knew as we started off this process that our rates were pretty good by national benchmarks. So this is about, we had a beginning of about 1.7 per 100 patient discharge patient mortalities within our system. We've driven that down to where we now are best in class as a system, nationally benchmarked, and this represents a 13% mortality reduction since our baseline of almost 2 years ago. In terms of the infections, the four that we mentioned, we also have had a significant improvement where we had a baseline of approximately 75 to 80 infections as a system per month. We've now driven that down closer to 40 per month, and this represents about a 40%, 39.5% infection reduction over the last 21 months. Questions about that data or?
And just to orient you to the graph, the pink line is rolling 12-month average. The blue line is the monthly average.
One other point here is this is not rate, and you'll notice that we didn't risk adjust in either of these graphs. And there's a purpose for all of that. One is we were looking to compare ourselves to ourselves. We knew we had some room for improvement, we wanted just to compare what we were doing as a system and see if by implementing the changes Jody mentioned, if we could see that improvement. The other is whenever you start getting rate information or if you go to the holy grail of trying to benchmark it by severity scores, it takes longer to get the data out. So this data is refreshed every 30 days, and so units can actually go back and say, oh, I had two urinary tract infections from a catheter. Let's go find out, you know, who the care team was, who was doing it, are there improvements we can make? And so it allows us to refresh the data much more quickly.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Thanks. On that previous slide, you have in the second, in 09, you've got 2 months that are like 30 to 50% higher than the numbers, than the months preceding and following them. Do you have any thoughts on why those are bumping up? I'm looking at, it looks like March and September of 09.
Vice Chair Parker, there's a cyclicity to mortality that comes over the winter months, and usually that reflects flu season. So the last 2 months, I believe that you're looking at on the mortality graph, is that the one that
I'm
you're
looking at infection count.
Oh, the infection count.
I don't have a slide number on it, but that one right there. We've got spikes in March, and I guess I can't tell if it's August or September.
It was
August.
Yeah.
Any thoughts?
We both look at each infection that occurs within our system, and when we have a cluster, we look as a group mm-hmm. to see if there are any patterns. In both of those, we were not able to identify a specific pattern.
Okay, thanks.
But it does, Vice Chair Harker, it does allow us actually to drill down to the individual patient in these instances and look for cluster data a single unit or such.
Right. These represent aggregated data they across do. Your sites, right?
These do. We actually report out to each one of our six hospitals their individual data, and we separate out the infections as well for each hospital.
Thank you.
So what does this equate to? If we hadn't done anything and hadn't seen the improvement in mortality and infection decrease, we would have seen 168 more deaths. It's not, as I said at the beginning, we didn't think we were doing badly 2 years ago, but 168 people walked out of our hospitals that may have not. 490 prevented infections, and this may be the catcher. You talked about how to incent hospitals to do this. We estimate that this is about an $8.5 million annualized avoidable cost from prevented infections because of things like DRG payments, depending on the disease state, and because of some of the never events that have come in over the last year and a half. It allows us actually to save money by doing this. So it's not only the right thing to do.
But tell us what the never events mean.
Never events were, Jody will explain.
There are actually several categories. The never events come from a list from the National Quality Foundation that lists 29 events that never should occur within a facility. Those include things like a retained object during surgery, performing the wrong procedure, giving the wrong type of blood. Those are never events by NQF or National Quality Forum. There also are CMS healthcare acquired conditions for which that Medicare does not provide reimbursement. Those are sometimes called never events, but those are types of things that unfortunately sometimes can occur due to the condition of the patient and with everything happening properly still occasionally occur.
Thank you.
We have all sorts of never events that happen in this.
Yeah. It's a nice phrase,
regularly,
isn't it?
It's me. So we wanted to talk a little bit about how we're achieving the results that we are, and we're going to focus on three main things. The first is ensuring evidence-based care through best practice bundles. You may have heard of best practice bundles before. In case you haven't, they're small sets of proven practices that, when done consistently together, drive improvements in care. The checklists are sometimes used as a way to help implement a bundle. A bundle tends to have three to six elements, so they're very small. And the an example that we've included here is the best practice bundle for preventing central line associated bloodstream infections. And you'll look at this and you'll say, this looks pretty simple. And the point is that it's not having a bundle, but it's getting to 95% or greater adherence that drives your improvement. And so there are many, you know, for each of the most common types of infections, there is a small set of known practices that truly make the difference between patient getting an infection or not getting an infection. And the issue is that you need to identify what are the things that get in the way of your clinicians being able to practice consistently according to these so that you can drive to a different performance. So the first thing has been these evidence-based best practice bundles. The second thing that we've been doing, and Jack's alluded to it a bit already, is we're focusing on infection counts, not rates. And there are several main reasons that we do this. The first is because it really helps us stay focused on our patients. You know, our board would say to us, well, I don't know what 1.2 CLABSIs per 1,000 device days means. How many patients got infected last month? The count tells you how many patients are getting affected by the things that are occurring to them within our walls. The second thing is it allows timely turnaround. Jack talked about weeks or months. It's actually hours or days. So, you know, the report that's going to be generated in April is going to be looking at data from 2009. So by the time it hits the press, it will be about 16 months old at the odds. For the work that we're doing, we're able to notify unit leaders and managers sometimes within hours of when we find out that there's a positive result and either a suspected or known infection. And we report each month on the data from the previous month. And so it gives us a very timely understanding of how we're doing. And the reason that for the timeliness is when you're doing rates, for device-related infections, which includes the ventilator-acquired pneumonias, the cath-associated UTIs, and the line-related bloodstream infections, your devices are the days that patients are on the appropriate device, so with a catheter or on a ventilator. And that information has to be added up, it has to be calculated, and then you have to divide it, and you have to use at least a month's worth of data to calculate a rate. And typically, those rates are calculated over a quarterly basis. For surgical site infections, you need to count the denominators. And again, those are, you have to count all of the same type of surgeries that occurred, and then you put that information together. And so there's just a timeliness issue when you're working with rates, because you have to aggregate all of that information that's kept in a separate place. The third reason we are focusing on counts is it enables whole house reporting instead of just intensive care units. When you look in the literature, almost all of the information that's been published about reducing healthcare-acquired infections has been limited to the intensive care unit. And that's because that's where the device data is. And so almost all of those rates are limited only to the ICUs. Obviously, ICUs are a very important part of our healthcare enterprise, but they're a minority of the days and patients that are in our facilities. We want to count all of them instead of just the ICUs. And finally, and most important, by using counts instead of rates, we're able to focus our resources on improvement instead of on reporting. Chair Greenlick, you asked a question before about how much data is required for entering into NHSN. For our surgical site infections, the minimum number of data fields required for a single infection is 23. And you could imagine just the clerical inputting, but the problem with that is you need to pull the records for those patients to find all of those data elements before you ever get around to the clerical task of inputting the data. And we have patients, you know, we have a trauma unit, we have a burn unit, and so we have patients who literally can have charts that are several feet in depth that we need to go through when we're reporting on those types of infections. And so by focusing on counts instead of on rates.
Medical record yet?
Excuse me?
You don't have electronic medical record yet?
We have the worst mix of paper, electronic. We're going to Epic. But, you know, there, even when we go to Epic, there, most lab systems are not adopting Epic because Epic does not have a so the electronic health record that many organizations are adopting is still keeping an old microbiology system because it doesn't have a robust system in most integrated records. And so there's still an interface, even when you have electronic records, of having multiple electronic silos that you need to piece together to be able to put your information together. So a big part of our work has been focusing on counts, not rates. And I just want to show you that when
you beat having to go through all that stuff, how do you get your counts?
Our infection control practitioners. And so we do that for targeted areas that we have concern or areas that are important to us, but we just don't have the capacity to do that for all of them. So, for example, before we started this work, there were 5 surgical site infections that we were reporting on across all 6 of our hospitals. We're now counting infections related to all of our surgeries. And so it has enabled us to look at all of it instead of just those few areas where the reporting and the data collection requirements are too onerous for our staff to be able to keep up. But what I wanted to show you here is we continue to look at rates in our ICUs because we do have device data. And you'll see here that the improvements looking at rates and looking at counts for, in this case, our CLABSIs, our bloodstream infections related to central lines, those improvements are very similar. They're running together between the rates and the counts. So we feel very confident that while we're doing counts, it's a much faster way of doing it, that it's still giving us a very similar answer. And so we track this to make sure that we're not seeing fewer because we're seeing fewer patients. So we still look at this, but we don't have the ability to compare this externally. One other thing you'll notice on here is that the rates do give you the ability to compare externally. Jack mentioned before that we wanted to compare ourselves to ourselves to get started. But it is also important to understand how we do relative to others. We're currently better than top quartile performance, and we're heading toward top performance. But the rate data does give you the ability to compare externally to other facilities.
And
We actually distribute this widely. Everybody in our hospitals down in the unit level, these graphs are distributed throughout the system. They're posted in units. They spur competition between how many months or years at this point some of our ICUs have had without a vent-associated pneumonia. It's hospital people are competitive by nature, practitioners in particular, and I think it's another powerful force. And what else are we doing? This was maybe our brainchild initially, but it was really the board that called us to task and said we can do better. And so I believe involving the leaders from the hospital presidents all the way up through our CEO and our board chair, we review this on a monthly basis with them, and they've pushed this along. I don't think you can overstate the patient-centered aspect of this. We actually just finished developing a patient video that every patient being admitted to our hospital will view upon admission. It's about a 7-minute video. A few hospitals around the country have done this. Hopkins was the first one to introduce it. And it actually calls the patient to and their family members into service. It asks them to, you know, if you see somebody come in that hasn't washed your hands, ask them to. It goes at falls. It goes at a variety of things that have plagued hospitals. Putting the patient in the room. We have patients on our quality committees now. We're moving to patients in all of our committees. And I think it's a strong motivator and brings a different aspect to the discussion. Safety rules. Jody mentioned that it only works. You know, the best practice bundles are amazingly simple. As she said, 4 to 6 elements of what to do. But the tough part is making sure they're all done every time. And so getting to the point where safety is expected, to where an infection isn't. When I was in medical school, a vent-associated pneumonia was just part of the norm. It was expected that 10 to 15 to 20% of patients on a ventilator would get pneumonia. We treat them with antibiotics, and some would get better, some wouldn't. Now it's not the norm. There's a new expectation, I think, that we can stomp out a number of these. Focus, we mentioned over and over, and I think that we really have focused on a narrow but very important and the most critical infections. It's driven down with that focus, not only the infection rates, but the mortality rate. Transparency. It's been said if you're going to go naked, you better be buff. In this case, we are proud of this data. And we didn't know where we stood, frankly, 2 years ago as we benchmarked ourselves. I was a skeptic that we'd ever get to 40% infection reduction, but I think we'll surpass our 50% goal in the coming year. Finally, we've tweaked this over time. This isn't a static situation. When we do see an outbreak of a particular infection at a particular hospital or in a particular unit, we refine, we go back, we revisit. And so it's a continual iterative process.
We thought we'd give one example of the continued iteration. Hand hygiene is an issue that plagues our industry. Studies show that healthcare workers only wash their hands about half as often as they should. And in fact, when we started this work, we were right there. We were in the 50 to 60% compliance rate. So the first thing that we did was move the infection team to the quality team. They had been part of the lab before and just weren't connected with the clinical stakeholders who they were a very important part of. The second thing we started doing was started secret shopper observations, which is really when you observe where those missed opportunities are, because it gives you information both about who's not washing their hands and when are people not washing their hands, so that we can target education and information to those individuals. The next thing we did is we discovered that our nurses were not able to tolerate the soaps that we were supplying to them. And so while they wanted to, you know, there's kind of, we have this way of asking, are people following the rules? And there's kind of two questions to ask before that. The first is, do you have rules? And for the bundles, you know, we didn't used to have rules about what that was supposed to look like. But the other question is, are they rules people can follow? And with regard to hand hygiene, we had nurses who couldn't tolerate the soap that we had out there. So we formed a nursing task force who tested a lot of soaps that were approved by the infection team, but that could be tolerated if you're washing your hands 120 times a shift. And then we started looking at, well, how can we reward this behavior? So one of our hospitals implemented a golden hand award, and they basically got a hand mannequin from a jeweler, and that gets passed from unit to unit for the unit that has the highest score. It's the most coveted award in that hospital. We also started administering appreciation prescriptions, and we have prescription pads that recognize people for keeping their patients safe, being a good role model, and other things when we catch them in the act of performing good hand hygiene. And more recently, we've also started with our leaders making phone calls to the units that are below 90% compliance to say, what's getting in your way? How can we help? I'm noticing that you're not quite where you want to be, so let's work on this together. And, you know, we're not there yet. Our target is 100%. We're in the low 90s, which is a lot better than where we were 2 years ago, but it's not yet where we need to be for our patients. And so we just thought this might be one good illustration of how relentless and persistent we need to be in all of this work.
Finally, in terms of getting granular and keeping this personal, we devised a graph, and as you can see in the background, it's the graph of the infection rates. But, you know, these are really patients, and they're patients with families, they're patients with careers, they're patients with jobs that they want to get back to. So we, each month for every hospital, distribute this graph, and the names have been changed here to there was a question about HIPAA earlier, those are patients that in our system had hospital-acquired infections in the month of December. The ones in red died in our care. We can do better. We can drive this down. I think we have to stay focused. We have to stay patient-focused. We have to stay infection-focused, but we can drive this down, and I think we still have a ways to go. We still have 40 or 50 infections per month in our system. I don't know if we can get to zero, but we're going to try. We'd be happy to entertain questions.
Any members? Do you do something like mortality and morbidity conferences on each of those deaths?
We do. What we initially did, and it was on the one of the slides earlier, a so-called mortality drill down. And what we did, every one of our hospitals took the last 50 deaths and drilled down to look for patterns of why. And, you know, there is a point at which the people die in hospitals, and we know that. And we know that we're approaching best in class. But you know, some hospitals had patients that were being admitted for comfort care. Well, perhaps an ICU or even a hospital bed on the floor isn't the best place for your loved one to die. So at that hospital, we started looking into comfort care measures and palliative care measures whereby we could get patients home or in a nicer facility to die. Other places, we, you know, associated mortality with ICUs. And so we do other things at that hospital. So, yeah, we did a 50 drill down. Now we actually drill down on each mortality on an ongoing basis. Once we sort of got caught up, we have the ability to drill down over and over.
You do that with infections now?
Yes. So we take several different approaches. The one is what we call a bedside huddle for a potential infection. So when we get a positive result, we'll try to convene around the patient's bedside recent caregivers to determine, you know, what's happening with this patient, what do we think might have occurred, what do we think we need to do next. In addition, we convene once a month a drill down of those infections at each site for them to look at what did we learn about this and how does it need to inform doing our care differently.
Well, thank you so much for coming. It sounds like you're doing a fantastic job. I think your point that at one time these infections were viewed as just there,
And I think the modern philosophy is there's no excuse for them anymore, and we'll eventually get to them. And you guys are showing how you can do that. And that's very impressive. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Come back again. Let us know how it's going.
I'd love to. Thank you.
I will close this informational meeting on healthcare acquired infections and open an information meeting on physical therapists and dry needling. And can we start with Mr. Finkelstein, Hyder, and Moore? Was that close?
Very close.
Hyder and who's the last one?
Representative Harker, and you're going to demonstrate.
Finkelstein, Hyder.
Harker wants to get dry needles.
Who's the last one?
We understand there's things going on in terms of physical therapists and a technique called dry needling, and we were interested in hearing what's going on with it. Also hearing from the medical board on what they think about it as well. So, please.
Chair Greenlick, does the committee want to hear what dry needling is?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll turn it over to a clinician. My name is Jim Hyder. I'm the director of the Oregon PT Licensing Board. I am not a clinician, so we have one here.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'm Mike Mira. I'm a physical therapist in independent practice. I own outpatient private practice in around Salem, Corvallis, Monmouth, and Staten area.
I wasn't even close with your last name.
Oh, awfully close there, Mr. Chair. I have outpatient clinics that have about 30 physical therapists. Only two of them are even considering practicing dry needling, to give you an idea. I am a clinical instructor for 7 different doctorate programs. I'm not an instructor in dry needling, but I do teach people when they come into my clinics for their doctorates. And if I had to give you an explanation of dry needling, is that what you're looking for, Mr. Chair?
Well, I suppose I need to go back and step one step back. Dry needling sounds to some people a lot like acupuncture.
Mm-hmm.
And if it is acupuncture, there's a structure for regulating acupuncture. So the question I think we're asking is, how is dry needling different from what sounds like acupuncture, and how does the structure for regulating it differ from the structure for regulating acupuncture? I think that's essentially what brought us here today.
Mr. Chair, I believe I can answer that for you. In general, dry needling involves conical needles, which is the one similarity between the two. It's also based in Western philosophy, anatomy. It's not an Oriental philosophy of training for this. Dry needling, what the technique is in general, is if you're palpating to discover trigger points, and it's based upon Janet Travell's work in 1940 on JFK's staff. But you're palpating muscles for trigger points, and you're placing a needle directly into that trigger point to release neurotoxins. Okay, what that does, it allows the muscle to relax. It decreases spasm. It's generally deeper than my understanding of acupuncture, although I'm not an acupuncturist. It's placed within the trigger point. It decreases disperses the neurotoxins within that, which allows muscles to relax, which allows a PT to improve functional range of motion, for example, or functional tasks, so they can get on with rehabilitation. So hopefully that provides you with some form of explanation for that.
Is there a pattern to trigger points?
Trigger points are found all throughout muscles. So we are not working within the Oriental philosophy of meridians by any means at all. And that's why I say the one similarity is the conical-shaped needle that we use. But I could liken that to, a hammer. A plumber, it's a modality. So a plumber may use a modality. A plumber may use a modality different than a carpenter for a different purpose. And I think another explanation of that might be, Vice Chair Harker, sorry. If I may so, modalities come in all, they're vehicles used to allow people to achieve goals in rehab. And electrical stimulation is another one where acupuncturists may use electrical stim. PTs use it all day long but they're for ultimately different goals. We aren't combining the two. We aren't utilizing dry needling for that purpose.
Well, what comes to mind, you talk about a hammer, but I think perhaps, say, an orthopedic surgeon and a hand surgeon might operate in two different ways on the same hand to solve a problem in that hand, but they're still doing surgery.
Certainly.
Even though they come at it from a different philosophy and a different approach to it. I guess it really gets to the element, I mean, to the issue is, what's the essential element that defines this process? What sort of education do folks get who do?
Well, that's actually, when I talk about education, I'm talking about, you know, doctorates of physical therapy. I went to Willamette for my undergrad. I went to Pacific for graduate school. The core training is very, 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 we're very comfortable with the thought that we can perform dry needling. I do think you need some training in dry needling, and we've discussed that as well, as an adjunct. I mean, if I were...
You were trained in dry needling when you went to Pacific? That was a part of the curriculum?
No, actually it was introduced to us at that point. But the anatomy, the physiology, all of the biomechanics that we work with are all just Western-based philosophy. So it's much different than, say, if I went to an acupuncture school, and I'm not speaking on as an acupuncturist, but it's much different in that sense. And so dry needling, like I say...
Different is where you put the needles? Is that what's different?
It's where you put the needles. It's different than acupuncture, for sure.
Okay. And how are you regulating this practice? What's your...
This, Chair Green, like, this all came about with the board 2 years ago with inquiries to the board. Is this within our scope of practice, from therapists, qualified licensed therapists, who wanted to know whether the board considered it as part of the scope of practice? At that time, the board had made an overt decision that it was not in the scope of a PT's practice. Upon further information being brought to the board held at one of its board meetings, rediscussed the issue, reopened the issue, new information was brought to the board, and based on that, the board still wasn't prepared to make a decision. They wanted additional information, so they sent board staff out to gather more information. We brought it back at the following board meeting, and based on that information that the board collected, made a decision that the practice of dry needling with the adjunct education, postgraduate education, would be within a PT scope of practice. We published that in a newsletter, and at that point there was a lot of pushback, and we got information, a lot of phone calls from both acupuncturists and therapists asking, well, what's this additional education? What is it that we need to do?
Like a master's degree in dry needling? Is that what we're talking about?
There is no degree in dry needling. It would be a special certificate of some sort. And we had therapists who came to the board and shared their information with regards to the extensive work that they've done postgraduate to achieve this level. This is where the problem came in, because the board said with this adjunct education, it would be within the scope. We didn't identify what that education was going to be. That's what created the one issue for the board. At the same time, after the board determined that it would be part of the scope of practice, we got information that the medical board and the acupuncture committee was deliberating on what the board's decision was. Based on that, the board invited the medical board to come to its next board meeting in public session. We had Mr. Finkelstein presented to the board along with two of his colleagues, along with the director of the medical board. And based on that conversation, that interaction in public session between the PT board and the medical board and acupuncture committee, the board went back and said, okay, we don't agree that, because the acupuncture committee and the medical board made the determination that the practice of dry needling was acupuncture. That was their statement to the board. The board didn't agree with that statement, but we did listen to what they had to say about the issue of public safety. You know, you've just said that it's within the scope, but you've not put out any guidelines out there what it would take for a PT to be able to safely practice dry needling. We've had conversations back and forth, and as late as last week, I had a conversation with the board director for the medical board, Ms. Haley. She's here today. And where we left it last week was she wanted me to go back to our board chair and have our board chair initiate a letter to their board stating what our board's intent was and that we would like to sit down at the table and have a discussion, trying to come to some ground that we could all accept with regards to PTs having some kind of regulation, whatever that's going to be, additional certification, a special license, a limited license, whatever that's going to be, so they can safely practice dry needling. So that's where we left it, and then I got a call that we're going to come and share information with the committee.
And I really appreciate you being here.
Representative Greenlick, I'm not quite sure. Chair Greenlick, excuse me. This is my first time here.
Welcome.
Thank you. I'm not quite sure how to jump into this whole
jump
mix
in.
Here. There were various questions that came
jump
up that I have some input on also in terms of the definition of dry needling.
Sir, if you could introduce yourself.
I'm sorry. Excuse me.
Thank you.
Representative Maurer, Vice Chair Maurer. My name is Malvin Finkelstein. I'm the chairperson of the Acupuncture Committee of the Oregon Medical Board. I'm an acupuncturist in private practice. I've been in practice for 30-plus years. As part of my work on other groups, I've been a member of the Board of Medical Examiners. I've been the chairperson of the National Certification Commission for Acupuncture, the group that certifies acupuncturists nationally. I was chairperson of the Examination Committee for a number of years and their Eligibility Committee. And I've worked quite a bit with eligibility standards as well as examination standards for many, many years. In terms of what dry needling is, if we look at the definitions of dry needling that show up in various dictionaries, including Merriam-Webster's and including Wikipedia, they define dry needling as acupuncture. That shows up very prevalently in the medical literature. The similarities are astounding. They're using the same instrument, which is acupuncture needles. They're working at going into points in the body, and I would beg to disagree slightly with my colleague over here in terms of what structures we're working at. Acupuncture is very Western medically oriented. It has a Chinese philosophy explanation of it, but it also includes a Western medical, physiological, and anatomical definition, all of which are part of what is taught in acupuncture schools and part of how all acupuncture points are defined. They're defined as what muscles they're going into, what nerves they're associated with, what bones they're near, what blood vessels they're associated with. And so differentiating acupuncture by saying it's some mysterious oriental non-Western medical thing is frankly very distressing to those of us who are part of the medical world and the acupuncture world. We really see them as being dry needling and acupuncture as being the same thing. There's nowhere else in medicine that we know that a technique is defined by what you're thinking when you're doing it. The philosophy is not really the question. The technique is the question. We're putting needles in. We're working with points. We're working with points that are in anatomical structures, and we're working at trying to release muscular tension, same as dry needling is defined, and regulating physiological function. That's kind of why the Acupuncture Committee and the Medical Board have put out the opinion that we think that this is the same thing, that dry needling is indeed part of acupuncture. We went to the meeting, as mentioned, and earlier in the process, when the Physical Therapy Board was deciding all of these things, they actually didn't invite us in at that point. Just mentioning that because it's an interesting omission to my mind. And we didn't actually notice it until we got calls from acupuncturists who had read about it and heard about it from physical therapists. And so we got called in a little late in the game in terms of this whole discussion.
Question?
Certainly.
How important are the word meridian and the concepts behind meridians to this argument? Because you're talking about them in terms of location. But my understanding of acupuncture is that the existence of and the travel of energy through meridians is a central tenet of acupuncture.
Vice Chair Harker, a very good question. The meridians are part of how the points are explained, but they are not essential in terms of the understanding of what an acupuncture point is. An acupuncture point is a physiological structure, and it's been studied by acupuncturists and by Western researchers as what its actual structure is. And there's varieties of opinions within the acupuncture world about what is actually happening when you stimulate an acupuncture point in terms of what nerves are being stimulated, what muscular events are happening, what circulatory events are happening. The meridians are one way of explaining it, but it's really only one of a variety of ways of explaining things.
Thanks.
Okay. Actually, this isn't the only experience we've had in terms of border warfare with the physical therapist. Mm-hmm. It's also with the chiropractors and the physical therapist on what's on your mind when you're doing spinal manipulation. It's some of the same discussion, in fact. But that we're not very good referees of border warfare, but it does make interesting discussion. Are you done?
I think I've completed with that part of the statement there.
Other questions? Representative Thompson?
Can you describe for me this conical needle? I'm picturing a needle with a point on it about 3 inches wide at the other end, and how that compares to an acupuncture needle. The same instrument, similar?
My understanding is that they're the same needles, that they do use acupuncture needles that are called acupuncture needles.
Conical needles, yes.
Okay.
They're the same needles.
Same needles.
I'm not sure we are a very good referee. I mean, we're good referees. The problem is that the rules of the game aren't very well defined.
Yeah. Chair Greenlee, I'd like to just let you know, I'd like to respond to one of Mr. Finkelstein's comments. The board did do due diligence when they went in and they made their decision. We did review, we had our AAG review the statutes and the rules for both the acupuncture committee and the medical board, and we had a legal opinion before the board made the decision that it would be within the scope, that told us that it would not infringe on the statute or the scope of the medical board or the acupuncture committee. So that's the information our board had.
How do you define, there's a statutory scope, and I'm sure there's nothing in there that talks about needles or anything like that. So the question is, what criteria do you use? I mean, if I came in and said, I'm a physical therapist and I want to start amputating fingers because I have this physical therapy philosophy that you'll get better range of motion if you don't have an index finger. Now, how would you decide whether that was in your scope of practice or not? What criteria to use?
I cannot answer that question. What the opinion we got was that there was nothing that protected the term, and dry needling did not appear as a term in the scope of practice for medical board.
Representative Chairman,
can you make that opinion available to us?
Representative Kimmelman, I will ask our AAG if I can do that. I don't know.
Well, you can do it if you waive confidentiality.
Okay.
They can't make it available, but you can.
Sure. I'd like to understand what they said, and that's probably clearer than asking here.
Ms. Haley, do you want to chime in on this one? Now that you're back in Germany? No?
Oh, I'm sure.
President Thompson?
What are we being asked here? Do we need legislation one way or the other?
We're
a little confused of what we're supposed to do.
We're being asked in this as in other border warfare problems whether we need to clarify by statute, I assume, in the next session, which is why we're having here about how to define scope of practice, what the boundaries are, or whether we don't have a legislative interest in it. And, I mean, the answer is when we get to review this, we may not have a legislative interest, and then everybody will go on their merry ways and take care of the public. What sort of training do you have? I mean, what sort of training does the average physical therapist who's going to now use dry needling, what's the minimum training that they would need?
I think that's what we're trying to determine here, is it not?
No, I mean, in practice, no.
Well, I have two PTs who are taking courses. Courses are provided to physical therapists across the nation on dry needling. And I do have two PTs who are taking them now. Again, I'm not one practicing. I don't really wish to practice dry needling. I have good results with what I do, Mr. Chair. So it's not something I want as my focus. But as far as the extent of training, you know, there's no formal program one must go through in the same sense. Just like every continuing education, I just got back from a Con Ed class in San Diego. I was there all week for all different subjects you could imagine. You know, dry needling might be one of those subjects. It wasn't at this combined sections meeting. But there might be just extensive training that people can take on that. And again,
like I
said,
there
are weekend seminars or there.
Or I might take they haven't talked online about, course.
Well, I couldn't imagine an online course, Mr. Chair, for something like that. I mean, it's definitely a palpable skill. I mean, one thing I am trained in is ASTIM, which is a soft tissue mobilization technique. It ended up being weekend seminars with practical exams and written exams at the end. And the criteria there, were well-defined.
President Hoyle?
Mr. Homera, so just to put it in perspective, it's not like someone could come in and take a weekend course and then say, I'm going to do physical therapy with dry needling, acupuncture, whatever you want to call it. What is
the... They actually could.
Yeah. They could at this point.
But what I'm going to ask you is, to be certified as a physical therapist, what is the criteria for that? Absent of dry needling, what do you need to do to become a physical therapist?
Well, currently, Mr. Chair, Representative Hoyle, currently all physical therapists are acquiring their DPT, their Doctorate of Physical Therapy. So my training back when I had this back in the day, it was a MSPT. So I went to Willamette for my undergrad in biology and sports medicine. I traveled down the road to Pacific. It's kind of a long story through the military there, but I traveled down the road to Pacific for to get my master's of science. And now a lot of the programs have beefed up. They're a DPT program now. So as far as the criteria to get your doctorate of physical therapy, you have an extensive undergraduate period that you have to go through, of course, and then it's more pre-med oriented. And then you have your doctorate program that you go through. It ends up being 4 to 8 2-month clinicals at the end of that. It ends up being an entire year of anatomy and pretty much your first year of medical school, if I had to break it down, your anatomy, your biomechanics, your physiologies, et cetera, neuroanatomies. And then on top of that, you're going into putting that into a functional base within the second year with some clinicals mixed in. Your third year is predominantly hands-on clinical orientation. When I went through it, I had a master's thesis that's taken out to provide more clinical or residency time. So I hope that gives you a better scope.
Yeah. So to say that anybody, like with a political science degree, I couldn't just walk in and take this weekend course. So you have to initially have this basis.
Yes.
To become a physical therapist. And then I'm not making a determination, but the fact of the matter is that there's...
That's an interesting question. I mean, let's ask, what if you did take a weekend course in semi-dry needling and now... opened your practice after a weekend course, what action would you take? What action would the board take on that? Not a physical therapist, just...
Chair.
I have a doctorate in social psychology, and now I want to be a dry needler, so can I take a weekend course and start doing dry needling? I think...
Yeah, Chair Green, like that's kind of where we're at in this process, and that's why the board rescinded their original statement, which they did following the meeting with the medical board, and advised any licensees who were interested in doing dry needling or who felt they were currently at a level where they could safely practice dry needling, advised them against it, not to do it. Not saying that it wasn't the scope of practice, but to give the boards the boards and the professional associations the opportunity to say, what does that need to be to allow you to be able to do that? And that's what we're kind of working on right now. So we haven't yet hit the wall, but It may happen.
Jim Thompson?
I guess I want to explore this a little further. As you say, there's national courses in this. What's the authority for nationally or other states if this isn't part of the scope of practice? I mean, could I offer weekend courses in brain surgery for physical therapists and we don't care if it's part of the scope of practice? I mean, how does this all come about that we're doing training for something physical therapists do that maybe isn't in their scope of practice? How do we get there?
Mr. Chair, if I may, Representative Thompson. According to information I received today, apparently 15 states have stated physical therapies within their scope of practice.
Dry needling.
I apologize. Chair.
It's part of a national trend going on?
It is a trend.
Chair Greenlick, it's a trend that is going in both directions. This particular situation is occurring in many places at the same time. And there are numbers of states that are saying that it's not within the scope of practice of physical therapy.
Have you thought of testing this in courts by charging a physical therapist for doing acupuncture without a license?
It's something that has occurred to some of us. I'm not sure that anything is happening with that.
I'm looking. Corey, would you like to join us for a minute?
May I ask a question?
Please do.
I'm looking at a website here that is Dr. Yuntao Ma in Boulder, Colorado, who teaches dry needling technique. He says in bold, dry needling has its own theoretical concepts, terminology, needling technique, and clinical application. It is not related to traditional Chinese acupuncture in any way. So, you know, I'm sure there are other people saying the same thing, but a question to you, Dr. Finkelstein. You say people are coming, it's a trend and things are going in both directions. Do acupuncturists continue to place needles solely based upon meridians?
Vice Chair Harker, acupuncturists do not place them solely based upon meridians. I do not myself. Mm-hmm. Trigger point, acupuncture has been part of acupuncture for many years. 20 years ago, I studied it with Dr. Mark Seem from the Tri-State College of New York. I've been doing it myself for 20 years. Just a comment about the gentleman from Colorado who is doing that. An interesting situation. Chair Greenlake, Vice Chair Harker, and committee members. This gentleman taught courses that he termed biomedical acupuncture for a number of years. He's now teaching the exact same material and calling it dry needling. In his own books, which he's using for the coursework, which are entitled Biomedical Acupuncture, he has a cross-reference of his points to standard acupuncture points. He uses the word acupuncture extensively in his book. He stopped using it in his courses for what we're dealing with here, and he just did do a class in Portland, which is one of the things that triggered this whole confusion that we're dealing with here. But he's one of the situations, and just an additional piece of what this person, Dr. Ma, does. Who's a PhD doctor, by the way. He also uses points that are not trigger points.
A couple of PhDs up here, so be careful.
excuse me.
Just because we have PhDs doesn't mean we're stupid.
We think we know everything. So.
Well, we do all know.
We don't?
I'm not an MD myself, so I'm in the same category as all of us here. But he also uses points that are not trigger points. Part of this discussion is using dry needling for trigger points, which is the primary part of it. And trigger points are defined in a particular way. And there's also a little tangent on this one here. There's a study done, if I can find it in my notes here. We'll see where it is. A study done by one of the doctors at Mayo Clinic that correlated acupuncture points and trigger points and found somewhere over a 90% correlation between the two of them. Dr. Ma goes beyond that and uses points that are not trigger points, but are what he calls homeostatic acupuncture points, which are, really acupuncture points in what he's doing. He uses the combination of those two. So we have even more confusions and situations going on. Thank you.
Mr. Gafford, do you have a dog in this fight?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Gafford. I represent the Oregon Association of Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine. I sent the committee over the weekend an email. I hope some of you got it. Mm-hmm. The basic problem here, Mr. Chair, is the state legislature defines the scope of practice for licensed professions, including acupuncture and physical therapy. In the case of the acupuncture statute, which I helped get through, it's very specific. It says this is what acupuncture is, and it talks about inserting needles into the skin, among some other things. I hope you would. If you don't have it in front of you, I hope you'll go back and take a look at this definition. Unfortunately, the definition of physical therapy, I was not around, although I used to represent the physical therapist, I was not around when that one was written. And it basically says that physical therapy is that which is practiced by physical therapists. So it's a circular definition, and it's very difficult for me to see how you could say anything is not physical therapy if physical therapists do it. And how do they learn how to do it? They take a weekend seminar. Mr. Chair, I'm not going to get into this battle in terms of whether it is or it isn't. All I'm saying is it's definitely your task, as I see it, the legislature, to define what the scope of practice is between the two professions. And I think that starting with defining physical therapy in a way that you understand what its limits are might not be a bad thought.
We can't continue to operate with that definition, you suggest?
Well, Mr. we use it for legislators. Ms. Haley, I would like to ask you a question. Could you join us, please? If you found somebody practicing medicine without a license, I was amputating index fingers or something, because I had a theory about that, you would do something about it.
Chair Greenlake, for the record, my name is Kathleen Haley, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Medical Board. Yes, the board would take that individual to civil court and get an injunction to stop them from doing that.
Well, if you believe dry needling is acupuncture, and you got folks doing it, why don't you take them to court?
Chair Greenlake, this afternoon is the first I realized that people were actually doing this. I thought it was a more theoretical discussion up until this afternoon.
Okay. But that is what you would do, wouldn't you? I mean, if you determined that dry needling was acupuncture and you had people doing it outside of the restraints that you have in your certification of acupuncturist, you would take action.
Chair Greenlake, that's correct. We would definitely be in consultation with our attorney about that.
Is there a reason to consider the damage that's caused or could be caused? I mean, amputation is a little different than
dry needling.
Dry needling.
Chair Greenlake, Vice Chair Moore, yes, the board's mission, as you're aware, is the protection of the public, and acupuncturists spend many years in training, and part of the training involves the sterility of the needles that are used as well as the technique. So there are some public safety issues that are in the forefront on this kind of discussion.
So as a follow-on to that, have there been patient complaints? Do we have patient complaints as a result of any activity?
Chair Greenlake, Representative Maurer, to this point we have had no complaints with, well, first of all, to answer the question, the PT board's unaware if anybody's practicing dry needling also. The questions were, is it within the scope? I have this training. I want to be able to use this modality. So I can't tell you that there are people out there that are, or there are people out there that are. I'm hoping they're all not. The statement that the board made was no.
Can I offer a suggestion? I mean, this is, I have an opinion. My opinion is that they probably shouldn't until we get this question answered, rather than the other way around. I think for their own protection, and that's purely my opinion.
Representative Maurer, there was a statement by the board that said, until we straighten this thing out, you should not consider practicing, even if you have the education. That went to all the interested parties that were at the public meeting. It went to all our interested parties. It was posted on the board's website, and we did a special newsletter stating that.
Sounds like you're in the right place.
In the right place, yeah.
Dr. Kenemer?
Thank you, Dr. Greenlick. I appreciate that. Mr. Heider, I guess a question. You said that you had an attorney's opinion regarding this practice of dry needling being within the scope of practice. Who provided that legal opinion, if I may ask?
That was provided by our AAG, Carol Parks.
I see, and that would be who the board of medical examiners would go for advice as well about pursuing a claim. Is that correct, Ms. Heider?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kenemer, that's correct. We would use an assistant attorney general.
Okay. I think we have an issue that if we're not careful, we are using the same attorneys to solve a conflict. To your point, Ms. Chair.
Well, they're each attorney is representing them.
I understand.
And we'll get the LC into referee if we need to before we're done. Representative Hoyle.
Being one of the people up here that does not have a PhD, I just want to really simplify what we're supposed to be doing.
You're still in the majority, don't worry.
Oh, good, good. Glad to hear it. So what we're being asked is consider basically a scope of practice, whether dry needling fits within the scope of practice of practicing physical therapy some point in 2011. And so this is an informational hearing to make us aware of the subject and understand that there's multiple points that we should consider. But in 2011, we'll be looking to specifically say, yes, this is part of what physical therapists should be doing because it fits into the job they do, or no, that's the job of acupuncturists. Am I correct?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Hoyle, no, you're not correct.
Okay.
From the standpoint of the board, where we've left this, if we cannot, as a board, this is the board, not, I don't know what the professional association is feeling, but as the board, if we cannot resolve this issue administratively between the medical board, the acupuncture committee, and the PT board, the board has no intentions of moving anything forward legislatively in 2011.
Okay. Representative Thompson?
You may have said this and I missed it. Are physical therapists trained to do sterile injections?
We're trained in sterile technique, not sterile injections. Mr.
Chair,
Thompson, sorry.
Yeah, well, somebody might take an interest in redefining the physical therapy scope of practice if it's something you guys may want to think about, whether you're happy with where it is. Not with regard to this question, but in terms of if you think you may need something more specific to help you do your job, that's something we'd be happy to look at. That's not a threat. That's just
I know.
That's an offer. I mean, if it's something that you really think makes sense to make your life easier, we'd be happy to help. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I find this stuff interesting. I think some of my committee members bailed out because they don't find
Could we get them to come back in the interim and duke it out? Excitement is building.
I don't know. I'd bet on Kathleen any time. We will close the informational hearing. And, we are not going to meet Thursday, guys.
Meaning we
Thursday
what
night.
About what's happening Wednesday?
We're going to try and see if we can make Wednesday. We may go to 6 on Wednesday, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to put the pharmacy at the beginning of it if we can work it out that way and leave room for you to go. But the leadership thinks we won't be around for a meeting Thursday.
Especially late afternoon.
I mean, especially late afternoon.
I am
sorry. Something else.
We are adjourned. Let's see.